welcome to Decolonize Everything, a podcast to start conversations on decolonization and disrupt the status quo by supporting new consciousness and liberation in all areas of life through practical tips and radical ideas. I am really excited to share this episode with you, a conversation with my friend and mentor, Derek Hudson.
Well, my name is Derek Hudson, and I'm an associate teaching professor at Colorado School of Mines. I'm trained in international relations. I teach courses in global studies and moral psychology, African studies, liberation theology, just to name a few things.
Yes, that is right. School of Mines, a STEM school for engineers of a high caliber doing work in earth, energy, and environment. And Derek is one of the teachers in this humanities department. Students are required to take some of these courses, and Derek has the beautiful calling to bring forth some consciousness around decolonization in the topics of religion and politics, particularly in Africa. Derek's PhD is from the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies here at the University of Denver, and Derek has some great insights for us today. Derek will be inviting us to think critically about this moment in the movement and the ways that there's opportunity for deep change. And some of that deep change has to do directly with the academy, kind of the ivory tower of the professor. It also has to do with kind of deconstructing that whole concept, decolonizing the way that we think about the academy and those within that system, everything from students to adjunct to faculty, and also the way that this is woven in with capitalism and colonization as an economic tool. Derek is a fount of knowledge and goodness and insight and wisdom, and so I'm excited to invite all of you as a part of our community to join the circle and listen with us, to hold space for this wisdom, and to ask the questions of decolonization and disruption. We can get started. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Becca.
Yes. Well, let's start with a little bit about what you're seeing right now. It's a really interesting moment in time, and you sit at a really interesting place. So what are you seeing in the world?
I think we really are. I mean, I know a lot of us, when we're in these moments of upheaval, we think this is like a moment. But I do think that this is a moment, and here's why I think that. So I do a lot of thinking about, spirituality, as you know, and religion in the world, and thinking about its role in the world. And I think it's pretty clear that all of us need quote-unquote religion with a small r or some sort of a unifying worldview to help us make sense of the world. That's kind of what I mean by that.
Yeah.
And with all that, and then we've had, you know, this sort of paradox of seemingly more inclusion from the 60s coupled with tremendous inequality. I mean, I'm not an economist, but the trends towards inequality paradoxically started to happen in the United States with the assassination of King in 1968. And I make that point because he seemed to prophetically understand that if we don't deal with the issues of economics, we will never see the fruit of all that we've struggled for.
Right. Yeah, people don't think of King as an economic thinker.
Right.
He totally was. It pissed people off.
He did. And in fact, as you know, after 1965, that's where he went next. And increasingly towards the end of his life, and there's a great book in which, you know, King went from a dream, the American dream, to the American nightmare. Because he increasingly could see that this system of capitalism, it was going to be very, very difficult for him to articulate the root evils of the system.
Yeah, and, you know, it's tied part and parcel with colonialism.
Correct.
Because it's that extraction method. Yeah.
Extraction, which has been happening for 5 centuries.
Yep. And that creates that gap and that inequality. And yeah, I mean, we can't fix that without completely undoing the system.
And you know, I was trained to think about the sort of benevolence of this sort of benign concept of the nation state that began, you know, and I teach it in 1648 in Westphalia in Europe, and it benignly sort of spanned the globe, which is a false narrative. This idea goes global via colonialism and imperialism and slavery. There's, I mean, if you're going to be honest about it intellectually, ultimately, that's how it went global. Mm. So it's an extractive image, and yeah, we've been living with that now for 5 centuries. And so now I think, Becca, that's what has been laid bare by the pandemic, and people have been forced to be at home and just sort of start contemplating what to do about all this. And I think all of us are still in this place of trying to be patient and abiding. Yeah. What's going to be the new religion, the new world order,
yeah,
which I know for some people that you and I know sounds utopian, yeah, and I'm not a utopian, yeah, but clearly what we have been living with for the last 5 centuries was never sustainable, mm-hmm, and is clearly more clear to more people that it is not.
Right. And yeah, like you said, not only not sustainable, but not the kind of world we want to live in. So can you connect a few dots between capitalism, the academy, and kind of the colonial reach into those spaces?
Sure. Well, I mean, the early days of quote unquote the academy was about the mind, the liberal arts. So there was a period of time in which going to university was supposed to be about liberating the mind, mm-hmm, right? So you would have a holistic sort of approach about the arts and mathematics and rhetoric. And a lot of the, you know, our older institutions like a Harvard and Princeton, they were sort of finishing schools. So we did have that for a period of time.
Wait, what's a finishing school?
Well, you know, kind of you go to learn sort of refinement and civility and civic culture, how to speak well, the arts, philosophy, rhetoric, etc.
Okay.
So Harvard College was a finishing school. William and Mary, all these schools back east. But with the Industrial Revolution and capitalism, that's a whole different logic. It's about you need to learn a particular skill, mm-hmm, to be productive in society. So after the Civil War, I mean, there's a lot of trends here. The academy began to say, oh, we need to train people. Notice the word I just used. Mm-hmm. As opposed to finishing school or the liberal arts, you are now being trained to specialize in a certain area. Say agriculture or engineering, you name it, the law. Mm. And so the academy started to become very siloed, so that if you went into a certain area of study, you increasingly had to become more and more precise, technocratic, technical, efficient, linear thinking, et cetera, et cetera. So capitalism and industrialization, that was what drove the academy in that direction. And it's only gotten worse, or it's gotten more intensified,
yeah,
since World War II. And we're now to the point, as you know, we tend to, you know, in society, we tend to have this sort of view that folks who are in the sciences and technology, engineering and mathematics, as useful as they are somehow more relevant and needed and important than the quote-unquote humanities, arts, and social sciences.
Yes.
So we've now got this sort of stratified classist system within the academy. And then within the academy, because everyone is so siloed and competitive, within the academy, there's all of this sort of insular sort of jockeying for position, who is the most important, who is the most valuable. And so then you, how do you do that? Well, you try to bring in money.
Yes.
You try and produce books and you do research, and then you're sort of showing the world, see how important we are.
Yep.
All our faculty are publishing and bringing in research grants. And so my point, Becca, it's this incredible artifact of quote unquote academic production, which many students, I think, intuitively get. It's not relevant to them at all. And they are paying huge sums of money to get degrees, which they might be saddled with debt. And they think, I could have learned this on my own.
Yeah.
I mean, this question you're asking is so complex.
It's a big one. Yeah.
But I think, you know, we are just at a point where how we think about education has to be rethought. Everything that we are, that we do, has to be fundamentally, completely rethought.
Ugh, it's so true. It's so true, and it sounds radical, but it's not.
It's not radical.
Say more. Say more.
Our longer trajectory, it was a very holistic, nurturing way that you would develop the human person.
Yes, not just the like little disembodied brain, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. And so we have privilege that the only thing that matters is your ability to rationally think, but we don't think about the intuitive, the emotional, the arts, philosophy, religion. So we have become so stratified, and here's a word we use in academia a lot, atomized, that we are not able to holistically bring it together in a coherent way.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people are feeling stress and feeling very disconnected. And in fact, one of my students even said it. So people were just walking around in knots. And I thought it was a very, very interesting way to put that. People were just have all of these, all this tension in their body and can't quite identify what it is, where it's coming from, but it's all in the body.
Yep.
So, I mean, we are truly at a place of axial moment.
Yeah, and when I think about going to grad school myself this fall and my own experience in college, an undergraduate, I do think about the fact that for me, I had a hint at this like freeing of the mind, right? There was something really good and important about it. And my work since graduating undergrad 6 years ago to now has been trying to figure out what the hell is my body? What the hell is my spirit? And how are those things connected to my mind? Because I, for the first time, felt like, oh, I'm good at thinking, and that's really cool, and that's really fun, and I can read all these books. And then I started to realize that I'm lacking something by just allowing that narrative, that colonial narrative of your mind is the almighty, right? And so what are some ways that you think about integrating that more holistic human side of things into the academy? Is that possible?
Yeah. You know, for those who are listening, you know, the holy grail of the academy is to attain tenure. And this is an idea that I think has gone past its usefulness. But the idea of tenure was that if someone wanted to pursue the mind, right? I mean, if you just sort of break it down, a doctor of philosophy is just someone who just has love, just pursuing the mind and the truth, and they've been doing it for a while in a certain area of knowledge, then you make them a doctor because they're doctoring, they're ministering, and always sort of pondering and thinking about a given area. So the idea was, you know, to give them tenure, you give them complete, utter freedom to explore ideas, and there doesn't have to be any particular immediate application of those ideas. It's just the sort of the exploration of the mind and to help people do that. Okay. Well, unfortunately, like anything that goes from an idea like that and then becomes institutionalized, people who have tenure often, and I'm maybe some folks who are professors who have tenure might find me a bit off-putting here, but I think a lot of it becomes you have to become productive. You have to become efficient. And I have actually even had colleagues say, you have to be formulaic. There's a formula on how you need to be productive in the academy. All right. Well, after a while, you can kind of begin to see how that begins to sort of push out creativity if you have to follow, ultimately, a certain formula in order to be seen as productive. So I made a decision to opt out of a tenure track position.
Right.
I'm a full-time teaching faculty. I'm very fortunate. But I don't have to deal with this whole apparatus of publishing and perishing. That's a term that we hear a lot in academia, that you publish or you perish. What a concept, right? I mean, that's no way to, I mean, when I started grad school, one of my professors said to me, you have to understand, Derek, if you want to survive in academia, it's a publish or perish environment.
Ugh.
Just let that sink in. So you're 28 years old and you're in grad school and you're excited. And then one of your professors says to you, now, if you want to make a career out of this, it's either publish or perish. So I had to ultimately make a decision. I'm not going to play that game.
Wow.
So I'm a teaching faculty.
Okay.
And so I think the way I take care of myself, Becca, is that I get to teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that keeps me energized.
And that's the work you want to do.
Right. Even though the teaching also has its own issues in the academy. But at least I don't have to deal with the whole bureaucratic, whole publishing situation. I think is what I'm trying to communicate.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked before about how there's pressure from both sides as a teacher, right? Like, you have the institution. You also have students who come in with these preconceived ideas about what they're supposed to be getting out of this, right?
Correct.
And so I'd be curious about an example or two of times where you felt that, you know, there's this power also, I guess you could almost say from below, in terms of like they're paying this money. They have maybe some sense of entitlement about what they're supposed to be doing in their classes. And so if you're trying to decolonize any aspect of that experience, you're in trouble when they write their review about you.
Exactly. Most institutions, we have student evaluations, right? So, I mean, kind of makes sense, right? Students are paying the tuition. And we have to have some way to evaluate the effectiveness of teachers. Okay. All right. So I'm in the class and I want to broach a topic, say, systemic racism or decolonization or some potentially controversial topic. Well, if I've got a student who is not there for that, they're there to receive some sort of a transactional instruction that will not really challenge them, and I do that, then in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about my job and my evaluation, because my academic dean will read it, the president may read it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, though, what I've been good at, though, is just to try to say to students, look, I am not here to tell you what to think. I am here to the best of my ability to just set the entire table for you, that I truly am a lover of wisdom.
Right, which is down to that core of why you're doing what you're doing and why you care about this. And because we've been trained in this transactional method until we show up at the university and we're trained to look for that little letter on our card, you know, like whether it's just to get by or to feel really good about yourself, you know,
right.
Like that's what we go for so many times. Even for me, you know, when I really was like falling in love with thought and questions, and I was still tied to this letter on the piece of paper.
Correct.
It's crazy.
Right. But you're right, Becca. The larger structures of academia do not lend themselves to this kind of a model.
No. And I mean, even the idea that we all would learn one way and therefore perform on a certain spectrum, you know, that constitutes these five letter grades, you know, it's just, none of it makes sense to me. And yet we play the game.
Correct.
And that's so much of this colonial reality, right? And so I want to also bring up this concept of being kind of in between a lot of things. And I think you and I both live a lot in that liminal space.
Correct.
In the world. And when you speak about it, I always find it really helpful and instructive to me as I seek to do this work in a trustworthy way, as I see you doing it. So can you speak a little bit about the ways that you feel like you're in liminal spaces?
Well, I mean, you know, the word liminal is, you know, it means just in between. So it, and you have to have an intentional, I think, commitment to not be drawn into what's called binary or dualistic thinking. And you see, this is another very important cultural value in the West, that it's either this or that. Yeah. So we are all sort of living in that sort of paradigm.
Yeah, and it's not just this or that, it's good and bad, good right and wrong. Like, it's very judgment heavy.
Right, correct. So how, so you have to be intentional to include it, to, I mean, as Richard Rohr says, we all have to start somewhere. And most, if not all of us in the West, in this apparatus, that's where we start. But for me, I think for you, it's how do you transcend that to non-dual thinking? I've been invited to start thinking about some sort of a center for race, society, and culture at Carlisle School of Mines, which is predominantly a STEM university. Mm-hmm. It could be one of the first ever in the United States. So that's a liminal space to bring these kinds of issues to a STEM audience. Mm-hmm. Because STEM, you know, the caricature of STEM is that they are apolitical, they are ahistorical, and they live in this sort of, we're very pragmatic, efficient, and we just, and engineers use this term, we just do deliverables. We just solve the problem.
I've never heard that before.
Becca, it took me 5 years at Mines to finally pick up.
Connect those dots. You're like, that's what's happening.
When
here.
A student would say, Dr. Hudson, could you clarify what the course deliverables are? And I said, what? Am I pizza?
Like, what's being delivered?
Am I doing takeout? I mean, what? Right? But now, I do use that term with those students, a course deliverable.
Yeah. But so it's thought of as like a neutral, it's very neutral.
They think it's neutral because they're just going to find out what the problem is, the technical aspects of it. And then they're going to do the work and then give you the answer.
That is not humanities.
So how do you liminally bridge?
Whoa.
So I do that all the time.
Yeah, every day.
Every day. So I sometimes call this, when I'm dealing with my STEM students, they're trained to think about the technical side of an issue. I'm trained to think about the adaptive side, so adapt culture. Society and that these other issues and domains are not technocratic.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. Yeah, I'm not in any STEM spaces, so I can't even imagine. What about your radical idea or vision for specifically decolonizing the academy? What would be like a radical imagining of yours?
Well, the one radical one is just the whole notion of tenure. I just think that, you know, this whole, you know, idea in the academy, that, and I used that term a minute ago, that people who go into the academy learn very quickly, or they're trained to accept the notion that the Holy Grail is to attain tenure. So the radical, complete upheaval of that is, you know, that, you know, all of these academic journals, there are thousands and thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, to say, are they of any real value?
That's radical. Right?
Are they really of any real value?
Yeah.
And if people start to say, maybe not, we're not going to play this game, that would be radical.
That's true.
So if the next generation of graduate students start to say to their professors, I don't want to play this game. Mm. What other game can we play?
I think
that graduate students could begin to really challenge their faculties. That would be extremely radical. And then the point is, you find other ways to incentivize people to come into the academy.
That's so good.
That to me would be the single most radical transformation of academia.
Because you're changing the end goal,
right?
Which just has to disrupt the whole thing.
Right.
Okay, I have my homework for the next 2 years.
There you go.
Thank you, Professor Hudson, right. Dr. Hudson. What is a practical step for healing in decolonization? Like, what's a practice or just one practical thing that you would recommend to listeners?
Proactively seek out people, authors, maybe a podcast like this that help to start giving you just the vocabulary of what a world that is truly post-colonial might look like. Just be continually open to new ideas.
Yeah.
You just have to be willing to listen to other people, to find people who are trying to talk about these things in new and interesting ways, even if it doesn't sound immediately applicable just yet. I think it's just sort of being patient with ourselves that as we keep talking together in society, that we're going to start getting a sense of where we're going to go next.
Yeah.
That would be my response to that.
Yeah, it's super practical because it's the way we show up. The way we show up.
Right. We're in this moment of upheaval, and so people are really, I think, lamenting and a great deal of angst. But, you know, if we can just be open that, you know, we have the capacity to transcend where we currently are. If we just are willing to be open to just new ideas. I mean, who would ever thought, for instance, you know, we would be saying goodbye to coal? Now, it served a purpose for about 100 years, but we are now a post-coal society.
Just like tenure.
Right.
We should move past that.
Move past tenure.
Just like coal.
Right. Right. So we've got to be willing to...
Yeah.
The change is coming, whether you want it to or not. It's mm-hmm. coming. So can we get on board with the change? So like in Taoism, don't fight against the current, flow with the current. Right.
That's great.
So I would end it there.
Great. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.
Going into grad school this fall, I'll be thinking so differently about the idea of faculty and the idea of absorbing information in the academy, the idea of how the Industrial Revolution has changed the way we think about thinking, that it's become a tool of productivity, of capitalism. We have so much work to undo these evils. And so there's wisdom from teachers across the generations, Derek being one of them, to help us see what is happening in this moment. How can we move through it? How can we transcend? How can we really expand our vision? So I'll be pressing into that as a result of speaking with Derek today, and I hope you'll be on your own journey to decolonize everything. Again, I'm Rebecca Mendoza-Nunziato, your host and conversation partner. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at DecolonizePod and Facebook and Instagram at DecolonizePodcast. I hope you will share this episode with folks that are ready to continue to pull back the curtain on colonization. Give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. And thank you. Thank you for being with me on this journey and this passion project of creating this podcast. All right, until next time, let's go decolonize everything.